Hello and welcome to the How to Make Friends and Influence People, the Southeast Asia edition of Intrigue Explained. I'm John Fowler, the co-founder of International Intrigue, the once daily briefing written by former diplomats. And with me this week, as always, I have Dmitry Grozbinsky, the founder and director of Explained Trade, a trade consultancy based in Geneva. Dmitry, how are we today?
We are very good and embracing your use of the royal we.
Well, yeah, exactly. I want everyone throughout this. Actually, I've got a story about this. I'll pause until after the introduction. I'll introduce Helen as well, who is my co-founder, Helen Zhang at International Intrigue, a world famous traveler, as we said last week. She's still in Australia. How are we doing, Helen? It's late there in the evening.
I'm doing well. Staying put for more than 2 weeks in one place, it's unsettling, to say the least.
Yeah. How are you coping with that? Are you sort of kind of getting used to a time zone for once?
It is. My body doesn't know what's going on, John. It's a problem.
I'll bet.
First time you unpacked a suitcase.
That's right. Actually, I have
another special edition.
Yep.
Oh, wow. Good. Another special edition. I'm in the US. Dmitry's in Europe. Helen's in the Asia time zone. We coordinated with much trouble, as we did last week, to make sure we hit our cadence and come to you each week, because this week we've got a little bit different, but really an interesting topic. We're going to talk about the state of play in Southeast Asia. The prompt for this is a report that actually the International Intrigue newsletter covered this week, that was essentially taking the temperature of how folks in Southeast Asia feel about the world around them. You know, they were asked questions about the US, China, the biggest things on their minds. And I think we think it's a really, really interesting survey to use as a jumping off point to discuss some things about diplomacy, geopolitics, and a region that I think both of you might agree doesn't get as covered as it should, given its importance to the world economy and to geopolitics. But before that, I think we can't not talk about this week's developments in Gaza. Let me frame that for you both before I throw you a hottest of potatoes. And we're talking here about, on Monday, World Central Kitchen, the fairly famous NGO that was founded by celebrity chef Jose Andres. I think it was founded back in 2010 in the wake of the Haiti earthquake. Folks might remember that awful earthquake. He stepped up this NGO that essentially provides meals. You know, it provides food, and it's gotten a lot more sophisticated over the last 14, 15 years. But they're often first responders in areas where famine is imminent, and that's the situation now in Gaza. On Monday, is the Israeli military, the IDF, struck a convoy of World Central Kitchen aid workers, killing all seven of them. There was a Brit, an Australian, a Pole, I believe in a US Canadian dual citizen. Yeah, and some others, killing them all. And it really very quickly produced the kind of outrage that we haven't seen for, I would say, a couple of months in Israel. Like, I think this, yeah. I was talking to someone the other day about this conflict, and they were like, oh yeah, well, it's off the front pages now, and it's kind of like old news, which is a particularly cynical way of looking at the world, but I think is kind of true, right? That it probably wasn't top of mind for folks as much as it was towards the end of last year, start of this year. This attack on Monday really, I think, did cut through and bring it back into people's consciousnesses. Since then, Biden has called Netanyahu. He's given Israel what seems like their last chance, which is, you know, we can talk about that. But I think it's important that we kind of just reflect on this week's developments in Israel and Gaza and then quickly chat about them. So I don't know, Helen, you served in Tel Aviv for 3 years. What is your sense of what's gone on this week?
I mean, I think it's a big, pardon my French, but a big stuff up by the IDF. Okay, that's not really rude to say, but I mean, really, they've really very quickly came and admitted that they made a grave error in their targeting. But regardless, I think the damage is already done, right? And I think it goes to the point of what we've been saying all along, which is that the narrative that they've been trying to spin of this is a just war, that this is, you know, something that has resulted in relatively low civilian casualty by the ratio of sort of military combatant to sort of civilian deaths. No one is paying attention to those numbers and those ratios, because this has really kind of hit, I think, struck a chord with people around the world, international audiences, particularly Western audiences, who see this and see sort of international citizens being implicated and embroiled in this, as Israel not taking enough steps to protect civilians as they've promised to do. So yeah, I mean, it's tough, right? But they are in a conflict zone. I'm going to say that. I think that even though they've said that, you know, the sort of the World Central Kitchen people have said that they flagged to the Israeli soldiers that they were aid workers, that they've said that they're in a deconflicted zone. They've also like put, I think, the logo on their convoy. They are still in a conflict zone. So it's just a really, really sad tragedy that this has happened. I think a few countries have really kind of pushed for an investigation on this, right? Like including Australia, actually, and Australia and some others.
Your experience in Israel and working with the Israeli government, and you know, I don't want to get too down in the weeds here, but you there is no sense that they would have done this on purpose or in any kind of way of like sending a message as part of war, right? It is just a situation of, you know, whether or not it's a mistake that was yeah. avoidable and they're being too reckless is a different question, but it wasn't. Correct. There was no sense that this was intentional, is there?
No, I don't think there's a sense that it's intentional. I mean, the official reason they gave was that they thought there was a Hamas, you know, senior Hamas operative who was smuggled along in the convoy and that's why they had targeted it. So obviously it was bad information or sort of some chaos and sort of miscommunicating what was happening.
Right. And that's the reason they used for attacking a convoy. But Dimitri, something is misaligned between the international understanding of how to do war and Israel and the IDF's understanding of how to do war right now. If they are willing to have collateral damage as 7 aid workers in a marked aid truck because there was a Hamas person on board, if that's the reason, and they were like, okay, let's go, let's kill those people regardless, something is disconnected between Israel internally and the way the world thinks is okay to go about war, right?
Yeah, look, absolutely. I mean, there's so much you could say about this, and I don't want to get too much in the weeds on that. A couple of reactions. First, there is the absolutely obvious point that Israel has been killing a huge amount of people in Gaza as a result of its military operations. And it is a pointless truism to say that it's morally somewhat dubious that what it takes to get this back onto the front page is an Australian and an American and a Brit dying. I mean, but it's one of those truisms of war, you know, how often was Syria on the front page? I think it's one of those things that it's not, I don't have a solution and it's not hugely helpful to say it, but I think you have to acknowledge it every time this comes up, because I do think it's important. Secondly, I think,
well, before you get on to your second point, can I just say on that, I take your point and I think you're absolutely right, but I do give people a pass for not wanting to read this kind of stuff every damn morning. Like I there isn't anything anyone can really do apart from stay informed in a general sense. And, you know, if it influences your vote or whatever it is that the way you, either side, if you care either side, there's a threshold of informedness that I think you have a moral duty to reach. But beyond that, it becomes war porn. And so I do think that that idea of, I think we should give people a pass for saying, you know what, I haven't been following in the last couple of weeks because I just have to get up and go to work of a morning, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not blaming anyone and I never would, sort of your level of engagement with this stuff, especially just like the average person in a country far away. I think everyone's got to set their own thresholds. I don't blame anyone. I just think it's worth saying that we're having the conversation because
100%. I mean, I wrote about this for our newsletter this morning and I was up quite late last night doing it. And the little amount of sleep I got, I genuinely had dreams of Humvees and missiles. And like, I don't play computer games, so it's not seeking in that way. Like it does affect people's consciousness. But anyway, I cut you off there. You were going to make another point.
I think it's a valid point. I think something that's come through watching a lot of the coverage, and there's been reporting coming out on this in the last couple of days, is two things are striking about the way Israel is conducting its military operation. The first is that there are a number of sources inside the IDF that have told journalists that field commanders have a huge amount of discretion to authorize fire missions in a way that the US military has long, long since forbidden ground commanders from doing in an urban context. So there's this sense that individual IDF commanders at whatever level are kind of running their own fiefdoms and making decisions like this one. It should be said that just now breaking news, the IDF is just held investigation and fired two officers that they say were responsible for this mistake and authorized it. But I think it's part of a larger systemic picture where their model of authorization for strikes has been very independent in the way that the US is approved strikes at a much higher level within the Pentagon. John, you wanted to jump in before.
Yeah, well, let me just add on to your point there, because with a quote from Sir Alex Younger, who is the former head of MI6, I think he said on Wednesday, actually, that the attack was, quote, systematic of an approach to targeting that has on occasion bordered on the reckless. It is hard not to conclude that insufficient care is being paid to the collateral risk of these operations. So I think that makes your point for you that clearly they are, that their threshold of these decisions is different to what other people think it should be. Let me put it that way.
It's nice when MI6 gives us our quotes in addition to our marching orders.
It's always helpful, right?
I think the other thing to keep in mind there is that, you know, the IDF has this mythology surrounding it, right? Because I think they kind of fan it themselves as well as being like, we are the IDF. We're kind of, you know, the hot shit in town and have done all these really incredible sort of missions abroad. But actually from, you know, anecdotally from folks who have served in foreign defense forces, from Western defense forces or otherwise, who have, you know, been in Israel as UN peacekeepers or other sort of deployments, have said that, you know, the IDF internally is a little bit more scattered than what they would, you know, externally project, as always, right? But it's also, I think the second thing is going to the cultural sort of Israeli culture of this chutzpah and kind of defying orders. It's much less hierarchical society as a whole, and then also there's a lot less kind of centralized, or maybe there's more decentralized decision making,
which has been, to be clear, lauded as a reason the IDF is so efficient and so excellent at what
Correct.
It does, because it doesn't have this kind of lengthy chain of command and it has great training and allows people to make decisions in the game time. But obviously we're seeing the other side of that, Dim.
This leads perfectly into my second point, which is one of the phenomena that's been observed in the last couple of months watching the IDF is the huge amount of, and this sounds trite, but the huge amount of videos that IDF soldiers are dumping onto social media of them doing, well, frankly, sometimes like war crimes, but a lot of things that you would not expect to see soldiers filming and putting on TikTok. If one of two things, so there's only one of two reasons that soldiers would be putting videos of themselves firing, you know, M5 machine guns at buildings for fun. One is that there is a permission structure from higher command. Two, that there is a lack of discipline. Either they don't feel like they're going to get punished, or they've been tacitly told that this kind of stuff is fine because it's good for morale or it's good for the home front. And it's not entirely clear which of those two things it is, or whether it's a combination of two things. But there is, at least from their behavior on social media, there is this sense that there might be a discipline issue with the rank and file of the IDF, or a sense from the very top that none of this stuff matters, as long as it's sort of, if this gets you high fives in the conservative press, like, go for it. If this gets you a million, you know, 1,000 likes in Tel Aviv, go for it. It doesn't matter how badly this plays everywhere else in the world.
I'm going to push back on that, Jim. I think, to be clear, I don't think the vast majority of Israeli citizens are supporting, you know, these, the sort of the bad things that the IDF are doing and the sort of omissions and oversights, right? I think they've had to kind of scramble together to pull conscription from folks who are, you know, Israeli citizens living abroad, or kind of conscript additional people to come in who have probably not been had, you know, combat training. So I think that this is probably not the rule, but maybe, you know, the exception. Now, as to sort of the earlier stuff that, you know, Sir Alex Younger was mentioning that John had flagged, I think that's a separate issue of this sort of systemic kind of chain of command stuff. Jump in, John.
Well, so let me move the conversation to, I think, the broader point, and the point that probably the three of us are a little bit more qualified to talk about, which is all of this is clearly doing a ton of reputational damage to Israel. You know, I think in the wake, I'll speak for myself, in the wake of the Hamas attacks on October 7, I had a bountiful reservoir of sympathy, you know, all of the stuff for Israel that you have in the wake of a horrific terrorist attack, which is what it was. Myself, I have noticed a changing in my sentiments towards how they've reacted. And I think it's fair to say the world as you know, you've got to be careful when you talk about this because there are people who had rusted on thoughts the moment anything happens, right? But I'm talking very generally from a global perspective. It feels like the world has gone from something similar to what I expressed to a place where there's very few people who morally support Israel's behavior now. And to be clear, there are pockets of societies that still think that basically whatever is done in response to those attacks is justified because those attacks were so horrible. But I would say it's fair to say that the majority of people around the world now share a view that what's happening is immoral and an immediate ceasefire needs to happen. And that's the American view, that's the European view, that's been long been the view of other countries. So this damage, I think, is undeniable. And the question we asked today in the newsletter and the question I'm really interested in is, does that matter? Netanyahu doesn't care, obviously. He's a political animal and he's focused on his short-term survival and he's got a country at war. So he literally just is like, you know what? They're anti-Semites and I hate them. And, you know, the Israeli ambassador to Poland literally called anyone who said, we think this attack is a disgrace and you need to have a ceasefire. He called them anti-Semites. And it's a classic trope that you just call anyone who disagrees with Israel's actions an anti-Semite. But is this actually going to hurt Israel in the long term? Does this stuff actually matter? Or is Netanyahu right with his calculus of like, who cares? It'll all blow over. We just need to get this done and move on.
It definitely hurts Israel in the short term and the long term, right? I think that in terms of, you know, or maybe in the long term, let's focus on that. In terms of any kind of settlement kind of, you know, peace agreements with the region, like you can forget the Abraham Accords and sort of renewing ties with the other Arab countries in the region. Right, I think that this narrative has ultimately very much dented Israel's position in the region as somebody that's, as a country that is a helpful partner to work with and that understands the sort of Arab cause and wants to make the Middle East a peaceful place. Whether that's true or not, right? But that's, of course, the sort of perspective and the optics of all of this with the other Arab countries like the UAE and certainly the Gulf with Saudi Arabia. And then I think that, you know, internationally, of course, there's been a lot of pushback on Israel. Like this has seemed to be one of the most divisive issues, you know, as we'll talk about in Southeast Asia, right? And a lot of other countries, Muslim countries in particular, who have now sort of, you know, view Israel in a very different light.
Does it matter, Dim, though? Like, does it actually tangibly, 10 years from now, does it change Israel's place in the world, the fact that this has happened?
Look, I think foreign policy on these kind of things, is it an existential threat to Israel, this changing of global public opinion maybe doesn't quite rise to that level. But if we look at it through foreign policy terms, if that's our playing field, you have, for the first time, the US effectively beginning to vacillate on its policy of a blanket veto on anything even remotely contrary to Israel's interest. Now, how much do UN Security Council resolutions really matter? Well, they matter enough that sort of the US has held that line for decades in the face of domestic and international pressure to hold it and at Israel's urging. So it matters a little bit. For the first time, you've got really hard questions being asked about military assistance to Israel and even military sales to Israel. Now, will those actually stop? I don't think so. But, you know, you've got Europeans starting to look at it critically, Germany starting to look at it critically, and even in the US, it's become a real conversation. And I think that previously Netanyahu, who let's face it, has been the Israeli prime minister forever, has felt that he could pick fights with especially democratic US administrations with complete impunity. There was this sense of there was nothing a democratic president could do, whether it's Obama, whether it's Biden, to Netanyahu, because Israel is just politically bulletproof in the US. And the fact that after the last tense phone call, Netanyahu reversed himself and opened some humanitarian aid crossings shows that maybe he's beginning to think that that iron wall of public opinion around the Israel-US friendship is beginning to crack. And does that matter? I think it does.
I mean, we might put a pin in the conversation there, but I think your last point there is really important. I think the nature of Jewish American politics and who they support and the fact that they have been, as you said, fairly united as a block in kind of saying, these are Israel's interests and we all agree on them, I think that's changing. I think it's changing as part of the Democratic Party. I think you've seen, particularly in Michigan, but elsewhere, Muslim Americans really make their voice heard with the Democratic Alliance, i.e. if you don't change this policy or at least acknowledge, you know, our concerns, there's a chance we won't vote for you. Now, I think in general election, when your choice is Trump or Biden, it's a very clear choice for Muslim Americans who's going to be better for your interests. But that's not the point. The point is more that in Democratic Party politics, who Biden is the president right now, it is not as clear as it once was that it is electorally advantageous for Biden to hold the line. It may well still be, but it's not as clear as it once was.
Can I say one last thing?
Yeah.
That as someone who is Jewish, has been to Israel, the way that Israel is communicating and the way that the Netanyahu government is behaving has made it incredibly difficult for those of us in the diaspora who even want to, you know, forget justifying some of this, even just trying to contextualize it a little bit and trying to soften some of the most egregious assaults. They are doing us no favors whatsoever, to the point where a lot of people who I think instinctively would want to say, hey guys, like, this is a complex situation. You've got to look at it from their perspective. Some of the things they're doing are in their vital national security interests, all this kind of stuff. The way that they are behaving and communicating has made that position incredibly difficult to hold. And I think that's going to matter in the medium to long term.
Perfect point to jump off and pivot to our main topic today, which is essentially, does what people think of your country actually matter? And the kind of impetus for this conversation, as I mentioned in the intro, is that ICS, which is a Singapore think tank, just dropped its annual State of Southeast Asia survey. Now, this is a survey that kind of tries to capture the thoughts of key officials, journalists, business people, experts across the 10 ASEAN countries. And for folks, I always have to remind myself which those countries are, and that's Brunei, Darussalam, Burma or Myanmar, Cambodia, Indonesia, Laos, Malaysia, Philippines, Singapore, Thailand and Vietnam. So that's the area where we're talking about. And the report is kind of meant to be a snapshot in time about what people who think about this kind of stuff from all angles, what they think about the world. So why don't we start with a key number and get your thoughts, Helen. Maybe we'll come back to what the region thinks of the conflict we were just talking about. But an interesting number for me was 50.5% of people surveyed now say they, or their country, I suppose, would side with China over the US. So an even split, 50% of people say China, 50% of people say the US. That's down from last year, so just in 12 months, that's down from people saying that they would follow the US or side with the US over China with a 22% gap. So that's gone down to China now is ahead by 1% or 0.5%. Last year, the US was the favorite by 22%. What's going on?
I mean, it's also the first time that this has happened, right? The first time that China has, right, quote unquote, beaten the US, even if it's by a very slim margin. So I think it's really interesting to see. I think there's a couple of things. One is that, you know, on the push side, China is doing much more in the region. Even if they're sort of, you know, just perceived to be doing more, this is a sort of state of ASEAN optics towards what China is doing. Secondly, is that there's a perception that the US is doing less and cares less about the region, is therefore less active in the region. And so if, you know, the big question there, or the most important word in there, is if someone is forced to choose, that they would, you know, choose sides with China. But of course, I think one thing to remember is that most countries would prefer not to side with anyone. They would prefer to sort of like pit the two superpowers against each other and have an a la carte menu kind of approach to, you know, I will side with China on trade and I will side with the US on military and security, which is not unimportant, right? Something to note.
That's famously the ASEAN DNA. They are a bloc which has been criticized for a long time because they don't do anything. They just sort of sit around and everything's consensus and nothing is done without everybody agreeing. They are the kind of US Senate of regional geopolitical blocks. They want nothing to happen. And, you know, they've always said, and I've watched press conferences in person with their leaders of those countries saying, yeah, but that's how this region has to be. We're so complex. There's so many different stakes. There's so many different constituencies here. We can't move quickly because if we do, we'll end up risking a catastrophic war here. So they would prefer to side with no one, and they would prefer everything to stay kind of the same, which is, I think, why there's such a shift in that number is so remarkable in such a short period of time. I mean, Dim, do you have any reflections on what, I mean, I guess what is causing, Helen talked about the China side, what's causing the drop off, I guess, in support for, or reasons to side with the US, do you think?
Well, I think Helen laid the groundwork there. The US is less visibly engaged in the region than before. I think it is fair to say that Joe Biden fundamentally self-conceptualizes himself as a domestic policy president. He ran on domestic policy. That is where his focus is. I'm sure he thinks the international relations stuff is important, but his focus has been on domestic US politics. But then secondly, you actually look at where the US is now. They are unconditionally supporting an incredibly unpopular Israeli war on Gaza. I mean, globally unpopular. They are failing to deliver aid to Ukraine. So they are seen as an unreliable ally, which they certainly weren't in 2022. They are on the precipice of electing Donald Trump, who is talking about things like throwing a 40% tariff on goods from absolutely everywhere, which that's if you are key, Asia that makes a lot of its money by exporting to the US, you're not looking at that and going, that's great.
That's the key, I think, because the question is worded as, you know, in the future, who would you side with? And I think exactly. A lot of these folks who are surveyed probably look down the barrel of a potential Trump presidency and say, and, you know, these are folks who are naturally unlikely to support, you know, their academics, their journalists, their people like that. The majority of them are people who are unlikely to agree with Donald Trump's position and worldview. And they're looking down the barrel of the potential 4 years of him and saying, boy, do we want to back the idea, sight unseen, that we're going to choose the US over China if Trump is the leader of the US?
But even if not, I mean, even if you take the situation as it is today, rather than projecting forward to a possible Trump presidency, you have a situation where US politics, which does in large part because of the way the Senate works, because of the way House races work, depends on a level of consensus in order to get big things done. And there is a sense that that consensus is just not going to happen on foreign policy issues, or you can't count on it. There's a sense that the US isn't necessarily a reliable partner the way it once was, and that a good chunk of its policymakers, frankly, take pride in that.
Right. And either of you, do you think that the number of people who are now saying they'd side with the US is linked to the people who say, and here's another stat from the survey, that 38.2% of folks say the US efforts in Southeast Asia have declined. So the idea that the US is kind of pulling out of the region or isn't focusing on the region. So there's these two numbers. There's one that's saying, oh, we'd probably side with China. We'd, you know, likely side with China over the US. But we're also aware that the US isn't as invested, or it feels like they're not as invested in the region as they once were. Is part of this just being like trying to pick a winner? And they were like, last year, they were like, oh, the US looks like it's here and it's committed. They're probably the ones we should go with. And then, oh God, they're not focusing on us now. So we're going to change our kind of the side we're picking. Is that what's at play, or is it something else?
Yeah, I mean, it's obviously, if you're looking at a triage of what America's top priorities are, Southeast Asia features quite low on that totem pole, right? I think they sort of look at NATO countries, and so the transatlantic frame is still very much front and center. And then for the Indo-Pacific, it's obviously more focused on North Asia, right? And the second thing is, as we sort of discuss in Intrigues edition this week, there's a perception of sort of like the US provides a lot of quantity, but less quality, right? So you know, this is referencing like IPEF, which is this like trade agreement that they think is really superficial. And then secondly, that even though there's military activities, there's not guarantees that the US would come in to save the day or sort of support them if push comes to shove. So the perceived sort of US absence from the region, I think, is sort of like if you are Singapore or Indonesia, who are sort of really the leaders in this, you know, ASEAN setup, like if you're staring down two term sheets, which one is better for you, right? And a lot of them see China as being a sort of more reliable partner.
And I think what you're hitting on there is a really important point. Dim, I'll throw it to you in a sec. Is that the idea that many people in the West see the world through ideology or morals or whatever kind of framework it is, the idea of like, how could you ever support Russia? They are bad. Or how could you support China? They are authoritarian. I think what you're getting at, and what I think these numbers perhaps suggest, is that Southeast Asia doesn't have that sort of starting point in how they view the future. They have a starting point of how do we best pursue what's best for us? And that's not mercenary. It's just not as starting point ideologically necessarily, like the US or the Australia or the UK. Dimitri, is that a fair reflection, or am I missing something else?
I think you're being a bit generous to the West there. I think Southeast Asia, just like the US, I'm sure makes moral judgments, but it also makes judgments about power, convenience, and history. You know, the close US friendship with Saudi Arabia isn't necessarily a ringing endorsement of Saudi Arabia's democracy or morality or progressive values. They are an economically important and strategically significant partner to the US, and they buy a hell of a lot of fancy fighter jets and sell a lot of oil. And so the US has been friends with them. Likewise, if you are in Southeast Asia and you are looking to your figurative left and your figurative right, on your right, you have China. China is always going to pay attention to Southeast Asia because it's right there, in addition to anything else. China is always going to be hugely economically significant to you if you are a Southeast Asian country because, again, it's right there. And on the other side, you have a US whose interest in the region and ability to shape events in the region and even economic ties in the region wax and wane with the tides of politics, and you are always going to be one priority among 12 for a US that is playing a role across the entire world and is putting out fires in Latin America, and now it's in Europe, and now it's in North Asia.
And I think, you know, this actually recently came out from a discussion at Asia Society with a sort of veteran Singaporean diplomat who was discussing the idea of the approaches, right, that or the views that Global South have towards how China engages with them versus how the US engages with them, and one being much more transactional. And I think sort of, you know, I guess on some levels much more agreeable than the US kind of values, leading with a values sort of transaction. And I think as the US's relative moral declines internationally with things that are happening, I think people are kind of less likely to kind of index on the US's supremacy and sort of what they're selling, right? Or buying, willing to buy what they're selling. But the West hasn't quite shifted on that quite yet. So I think, you know, it'd be interesting to see a year from now what the stats will be for this survey. I'd wager much more folks, you know, indexing on China versus less on the US.
I mean, it won't surprise either of you to know that I have strong views about what should happen in the region, but we'll come back to that later. I think I want to make 2 points. And the first is that, like, we have to, I probably should have said at the start as I introduced this topic, you always have to throw a blanket over these kinds of survey results and say they are survey results. We know that over time, surveys are becoming less and less reliable. People, you know, they either don't think clearly about stuff when they're asked a question, they want to just get to lunch or they want to get to their next meeting or whatever, or they don't tell you what's really on their mind because they want to deliver a message to a surveyor or something like that. Now, I'm not saying that the results are completely useless because, you know, maybe that's only a small percentage of people, but we know from political polls, from all this kind of stuff, that we have to take these results with a grain of salt. So maybe focusing on the specific numbers is a little too granular, but perhaps the shift in sentiment might be the better kind of thing to focus on, which I think is what we're doing. But I want to tie that to, we've got people saying we'd side with China, we're unhappy, or we think that the US has kind of declined its efforts or it's decreased its efforts in the region. And yet 50.1%, the same amount of people who say they'd probably side with China, are uneasy about China. Dimitri, you said, China's always going to focus on the region because it's right there. I think that's a bug, not a feature. Like, I don't think that, like, in their bones, countries who border China trust China. There's a long history of China not treating Vietnam, Cambodia, Korea, Japan, all of these. And when I know that Korea and Japan weren't surveyed, but China isn't necessarily a great neighbor. So is that kind of adding to my point that they are just more like, well, you know, we for one welcome our insect overlords and remind them that we can toil in their underground sugar caves? And or is it a idea of, oh, we actually think China's better for the world?
Yeah, I mean,
it's a deep cut Simpsons quote for those folks who are wondering, by the way.
I mean, first of all, if there is a fire-breathing dragon in the room, I would want to be on its side in a fight.
Exactly.
I'm pretty nervous about it. So I think those two things aren't necessarily in conflict. But I do think you can read something into those survey results where there was one of the results was something like 30% believe that China could play a role in the region that is supportive of kind of ASEAN's objectives and the broader prosperity of the region. And that was a plurality. So it's not 30% doesn't sound like a lot, but it was sort of 30%, and that was the largest category. While, as you say, 50% were basically sensing a level of threat from China. And I think that reflects an external perception that China has a huge amount of potentiality, and that while China is kind of keeping its hands to itself, there is a sense that China, even if you don't necessarily fully align with all of its values, and even if you don't agree with them on everything, while China is kind of internally focused and commercially transactional, or even diplomatically transactional with other partners, cool, you can work with that. That is a predictable, you know, even if a partner is transactional, transactionality is predictable. You can work with it. You don't like the price that they're offering, maybe you don't pay it, but you know, you work with that. But there is also this sense of menace is too strong a word, but there is this sense of unpredictability in the sense that China could be potentially very, very dangerous, in the sense that if the Chinese Communist Party decides that some element of your policy is a significant problem, their capacity and their willingness to kind of influence it and the amount of power they can deploy is inherently threatening. And that doesn't have to be a judgment on their character. It's just simply China is very, very big and willing to be quite brazen.
What would China be saying behind closed doors to ASEAN countries to kind of, I don't know, encourage the direction of this survey to continue?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, they would continue along the you stick with us and, you know, you'll be right kind of thing, right? The whole tributary states kind of history, as you alluded to, John, which I think, you know, some countries more than others within ASEAN, like Cambodia, like Laos, are very much within that orbit and still feel the kind of pull of that traditional historical kind of tributary state thing. Whereas I think, you know, to other more sort of, I think where there's more high tension countries like the Philippines and Vietnam, where they've got sort of, you know, territorial water disputes, disputes in the ocean. The sea? Yeah. South China Sea.
It doesn't matter. The water, yeah, I think, yeah, is the right
here. The water, correct, yeah. You know, with those countries where it's a little bit more sort of high tension, then I think they would sort of be very much offering up that sort of Hu Jintao version of kind of China, or the sort of, you remember that sort of China pre-Xi kind of, you know, we're abiding our time and we're all right. Together and we're collective harmony, and a lot of those buzzwords.
Well, what you're putting your finger on, I think, is why China's behavior in the South China Sea is so hard to square with their diplomatic goals in the region. And I suspect, having no sense of what's really going on behind the scenes in the Chinese Communist Party, but I suspect that is a major fault line behind closed doors in Beijing, that MFA, the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, is probably going, you did what to the Philippines yesterday? Oh my God, I'm going to have to go and explain this to Vietnam tomorrow. Oh my God, my trip to Jakarta next week is going to be an absolute shit show, right? Like, and the PLA, the People's Liberation Army, Navy, Coast Guard, whoever's, you know, causing the grievous offense.
I think they were just fishermen, weren't they, apparently?
Exactly.
Half the time. Exactly. They're just random Chinese fish people.
Exactly right. But the militarized, securitized elements of the Chinese government clearly feel like they can act with impunity under Xi, are going, oh, you know, go away, egghead, with your diplomacy and your soft power. Like, we will, if they don't like it, we'll force them to do it. And it's obviously a fault line. And I don't want to turn this into a conversation about China again, because it's about Southeast Asia. But I do think it's relevant to sort of say that, like, you know, Singapore knows how to deal with China. Vietnam, Cambodia, that they've got a long history of dealing with China. So I know they're watching these events and going, well, you know, US isn't...
History shows.
Yeah, maybe the US isn't forever, but also China, we have to be careful as well.
Final thing that we should have probably mentioned at the beginning is just how diverse the ASEAN countries actually are as well, right? Both in terms of, you know, economics, in terms of their religious diversity, and in terms of their histories, right? And
which sort of is why they move so slowly, because there's so many different constituencies.
Yeah, absolutely.
To circle back to your earlier question, John, about what a Chinese diplomat saying, I think one of them, you know, if elections are about choices, then I think great power diplomacy is about contrasts. And they would say, hey, listen.
Put that on a t-shirt.
You may find us sometimes a little bit menacing, but look who's actually in everybody's business. You know, the worst thing you can say about us is maybe your kid's TikTok is spying on you. Look at, you know, they'll pull out those maps of NATO bases all over the world, the ones that they Photoshop where NATO ends up having like 1,300 bases, some of them under the ocean and then sort of North Korea.
Well, even just Vietnam.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like we're barely a generation removed from what I think a lot of people, whether rightly or wrongly, believe was a systematic war crime.
Yeah.
They go, listen, the US is actually the one that might wake up one morning and decide that your country needs regime change because...
Dump napalm on you, for God's sakes.
Yeah, or you know, they literally removed a leader in Saddam Hussein. I mean, whatever you may think about the sort of, mm-hmm. you know, I'm not a fan of the guy, but the US effectively unilaterally decided that the leader of a country shouldn't be the leader of a country anymore. And China would say, hey, listen, you know, this is as menacing as you find us potentially... The US is that menacing in practice. And then they'll roll out the list of sort of CIA coups, which we've talked about.
And
they'll
be like, and you can't prove that we've done that. we may have done it, but you can't prove it.
I mean, one thing we can prove is the fact that the US has somewhat like 800 bases in the world, and like what Russia has like about 9, and many countries have 0. So that's something to mm-hmm. keep in mind as well.
I mean, the US didn't like drop those in forcibly. They were invited into those countries, which is, I think, useful nuance and something for both China and Russia to remember. Just like it's not the US's fault; no one likes you. But I think to your point, I think that they would send that message, and I think they would also be sending potentially very different messages to a country like the Philippines, which, by the way, in this survey. Like the reason the Chinese positive numbers aren't a lot higher is because the Philippines is in that survey and they dragged it right down. Yeah. So I think they would be to countries that aren't the Philippines, they would be, or the ones that they don't have active territorial disputes with, they'd be going, listen, you guys are fine. Like, yes, we can be a little bit, you know, we're going to firmly defend Chinese interests where we believe the injustice has been done against us. But you guys are cool. Myanmar, we're okay. We don't have any beefs with you, and that's not likely to change. You know what our longstanding bugbears are. It's sort of Taiwan. It's the South China Sea. Even if you think we are belligerent in very historically predictable ways. If we don't have a map dating back to like the Jin Dynasty that says a big part of your country is actually our country, you're fine. And so you can look at us with predictability.
You never know what map they're going to find tomorrow, though.
That's right. And also, you never know what's going to happen if they give these places a panda, right? If we have a panda thrown in the next year's polls. So.
Exactly. The Trojan panda. The final number I want to talk about, I think, kind of closes out the conversation with going back to the Israel-Hamas conflict. It was a question in the survey, and I think the results are actually interesting from a bunch of different angles. But basically, the 46.5% of folks said that the Israel-Hamas conflict is now Southeast Asia's top geopolitical concern. Mm. I find that number incredibly surprising for a few reasons. One, it obviously doesn't have any kind of geographical relevance to the region. There's no supply chain issues. There's no direct effect on the lives of people in the region. Obviously, a portion of ASEAN countries are Muslim majority or have significant Muslim populations. So we're talking Malaysia, Indonesia, Brunei, these countries. So there's a moral concern, presumably, around the conflict because of solidarity with folks in the region. But the idea that they think it's more of a geopolitical concern than the South China Sea is interesting to me. And I obviously think that, Dimitri, you mentioned it, it reflects poorly on the US because the US has been supporting Israel unconditionally and China has been very vocal in the region saying that ceasefire day one, all that kind of stuff, regardless of what you think of the issue, that's the dichotomy between US and China in the region. But I am surprised that so many folks in the region who think deeply about this think that is the number one thing on their worry list, that they are so concerned about this. That surprises me. Any reflections there?
I mean, first of all, there are a number of Muslim majority and countries that do feel a sense of kinship with the Palestinian cause on a shared religious level. I don't say that as sort of a qualifier. I just think that could explain part of it. And I think if you consume Arab language media and media that is aimed at the Muslim world, Gaza is far more prominent and hasn't fallen off the front page the way it has in the West. So one of the things is like the South China Sea makes news from time to time everywhere. But I think Gaza, if you watch Al-Mayadeen, if you watch Al Jazeera, if you watch CNN Arabic, like any of those things, Gaza has been significantly more prominent. So it's just in people's faces a lot more. And let's face it, what's being seen is horrific. So I can appreciate why if you're being, as you were saying, if you are waking up to that every morning, why you would think that is a more significant thing than what some Chinese Coast Guard did to a Filipino fishing boat last week.
Well, I think you're touching on an important point too, because I mean, we don't have to get into this because it's a whole can of worms. And I know I'm the one who generally like opens cans of worms left, right, and center and then leaves them open. But Al Jazeera, for example, it has done very good kind of on the ground reporting in Gaza, and its reporters are very brave, but there is in no way a sense that it is a balanced news organization. I read Al Jazeera every day and it's reports from the ground are shot through with adverbs and opinion and terms of moral judgment. And like, again, that's fine. I get that. And you could say the same about certainly a lot of Israeli papers or American papers or European papers that have been traditionally kind of pro-Western or whatever. So I'm not making an equivalence there that they're not allowed to do it, but you've just framed it like that's probably the media environment that particularly the Muslim countries in Southeast Asia are swimming in. So there's a real sense that they're probably not getting a balanced or fact-based view of what's going on. I think it's an important point.
It's also important to note, I think, that there's always a sort of, you know, people get desensitized to their own sort of situations, right? Similar to when a few weeks ago I was in Korea, and I remember speaking to the Koreans about this, you know, drumbeat that the North had sort of started beating again, and everyone was like, oh no, we're fine. They do this all the time. It's not a threat at all. We're much more concerned about AI, for example. And so I think there's an element of sort of like your present bias and just the psychological elements for people when they think about this stuff. It's always things that are a little bit more out of reach and not sort of the environment they live into.
Yeah. I mean, on the media point, Al Jazeera loads it up with adverbs while the New York Times
has well, the difference there also, and I hate to keep like sounding like I'm a one-note Johnny here, but is also Qatar-owned exactly. and funded, which is the host of Hamas. You know, again, I'm not saying Qatar is involved in that, but there is no sense that Al Jazeera is interested in painting as balanced a picture as you could. I mean, it's a tough thing to do anyway. I don't believe there is balance. I think everything is biased. But we're not even Al Jazeera. I think it's important to note that Al Jazeera is not particularly trying, right? And then, you know, continue with your point about the New York Times, which I agree with you.
Yeah, I guess if I was defending Al Jazeera, I'd go, you know, if Al Jazeera is leaning too much on like, these are horrific crimes committed by monsters, the New York Times, meanwhile, is making an art form out of passive voice. And it's a lot of like, you know, fair three point. Children cease to have heartbeats in the proximity of debris from whoa is the headline. And then you read it and it was like a hellfire missle through a window.
We're going to get letters, Dimitri.
That's, I mean, I disagree equally with split that, to Jim, you and me.
Right.
But it's a fair point. I think I take the spirit of the point.
I think all media organizations can be better and it's hard to find the right tone. But I think the situation is horrific enough that even if it were being delivered completely straight bat, sort of Reuters headline, just the fact stuff, I think there would be enough there to potentially sway opinion in some of these countries where, given the volume of coverage on that side. I would also say that I think you alluded to this before, that sometimes surveys are a way for people to signal their outrage and signal their depth of feeling rather than necessarily sort of strictly quantifying their risk matrix in terms of how likely is this to affect me and how likely is it to happen,
yes.
how big the impact would be. When a survey asks you, what are you thinking about? I think, you know, what are you most concerned about at the moment? When someone says Gaza, that doesn't necessarily mean that what they're saying is the thing that I think will most affect the national security of my country or the safety of my family is what's going on in Gaza. What they're saying is this is what I'm currently most concerned about in that it is taking up the most CPU in my brain. And I think that in part has to relate with the fact that it's very visual, it's very current, and it's...
I think it's a really, really important point about primary elections, polls, surveys, is that people... Maybe it took a little while. Maybe there's a lag between the invention of the internet and digital communications and people kind of understanding how to communicate in this new era. But I think you're exactly right that people understand that this is an opportunity for them to send a message that is perhaps a layer, a shell around what, as you said, like decision time, this is how I'm going to assess this decision. This is my risk matrix. The survey response, the poll, the primary election is a chance for them to send a message that this is how I feel about something, and this is what I would like to change about the world, or this is what I would like to, you know, if to the extent that I can have influence, this is how I would direct it. But it doesn't necessarily correspond. It may, but it doesn't necessarily correspond to how they actually would make decisions in the kind of heat of the moment. And I think it's a really important point because we, again, zooming out, and it's maybe a good way to wrap it, we can directionally discuss these things because of what it says is, yes, Southeast Asia is taking up the most, Hamas is, and Israel is taking up the most CPU in Southeast Asian brains, people, these kinds of people's brains, but it probably isn't the thing that they are spending money to mitigate. They're probably not buying tanks or submarines because they're worried about Israel and Hamas. They're buying it because they're worried about the region, but the survey doesn't capture that.
Can I make one point about why it does, though, like this public opinion stuff does matter policy?
Please do, yeah.
And you folks probably know this even better than I do. One of the things that helps in foreign policy is whether it is a good news story for your country to be seen to be doing a deal or doing or collaborating with my country, or for your leader to be standing next to my leader. When you have a wildly popular president, you can leverage that by saying, hey, listen, if you collaborate with us on this thing, Barack Obama, who currently enjoys an approval rating in your country of 142%, will come to your country and you will have the opportunity to sort of wrap your hands around each other and be sort of and bask in that kind of reflected glow. If your country and your leader is deeply unpopular, collaborating with you starts to come at a political cost. Sometimes you will want to, as a government, you will want to collaborate with another country, say doing a trade agreement, because it makes commercial sense, for example. But you're like, if we are seen to be doing a trade agreement with you, we're going to get hit in the papers. You know, we may still do it. We may heed the business lobby and we may still think it's a good idea, but there is going to be a political cost to this rather than a political benefit on balance. And I think this kind of soft power stuff helps make partnerships with you and collaborations with you a net positive or a net negative, depending on whether it's good or bad. And I think that does matter in international relations in a way that's sometimes not discussed.
I think that's a really good way to end it. I think it's a nice summary of why people should, why countries do focus on this stuff on the margins, is because it makes it easier or harder to do business in the world. Frankly, I'm just shocked that the survey didn't list as 100% top concern the fact that Singapore hogged Taylor Swift and didn't allow her to go to other Southeast Asian nations.
I was wondering
nations.
If we're going
to
mention that.
If I was a Thai or a Cambodian or a Indonesian, I would be absolutely livid. But we'll leave that there. As we always do, wrapping the conversation, we will discuss something interesting. And let me to both of you, let me just again, interesting, not grim, light, keep it light, cocktail chatter. Don't be the person at the party who everyone leaves going, who the hell was that? I can't handle them. And I'm not looking at either of you in particular, Dimitri.
So but
so again,
you feel so seen.
What are you going to be chatting about this weekend when you're trying to cheer people, not depress them? Dim, why don't we start with you?
So there's a new strain of virus. That's it, though.
There is. I did see that. Someone got bitten by a monkey in Hong Kong.
Stop it. Stop it, both of you.
Talk about that.
No, I actually wanted to pick up on something that Helen recommended and you both recommended last week, which is the three body problem.
Yes.
Ooh.
I listened to you on that, if on nothing else, obviously. And we started watching it and it is phenomenal. I cannot recommend it enough. And I look forward to reading the book. But one thing that just as an aside, something that I found interesting about it is there are parts of it that I would see as quite critical of at least historical China, not necessarily in the bits that I'm up to sort of present day, but the show is quite unflinching in demonstrating sort of the brutality of the Cultural Revolution and the sort of fanatical myopia.
The book paints a very grim picture of the struggle sessions and that kind of stuff. It's unflinching,
And so I guess as someone who doesn't follow China very closely, what surprised me about that was the sort of contrast where you have like John Cena or whatever issuing groveling apologies to China when he sort of misspeaks, when you have, you know, maps in movies getting edited because China doesn't like the way the borders are drawn. And this sense that big studios are tiptoeing around CCP sensibilities. It was really strange to see a very much kind of China coded, but sort of a project that is very Chinese in some ways, based on a Chinese book, set in part in China, really just take some, throw some big punches. I found that surprising.
It's beyond the scope of this lighthearted bit of the podcast to talk about it in depth, but China has the current Communist Party has a very complex relationship with that particular period of its history.
Exactly.
Since Deng Xiaoping in the early 80s, Mao was largely, if not discredited, he was largely put in a bucket of, we can't disavow him because he founded modern China, but boy, were there a lot of things that he did wrong. He's just starting to get rehabilitated a little bit under Xi Jinping, but the Cultural Revolution element, the struggle sessions, the Red Guard, the violence that came in that period is still a portion of Chinese history that I think it is kind of, within very limited bounds, okay to criticize in coded language in China. Whereas what you're talking about, the idea that South China Sea isn't historically China's or the Communist Party doesn't have the right to rule China, that stuff, absolutely verboten. And I think Netflix would never touch it. This might be the one little shell of stuff about China's recent history that might be okay to be a little bit critical about. I think that might be the case. But you know, it's an interesting point, Dimitri, and I am going to watch the Three Body Problem now because I can't deny both of your recommendations.
It's fascinating. I mean, not like Pandemic Monkey, but still a fascinating cocktail conversation.
Okay. Mine is a completely different tack. I get to nerd out every so often. I love space. I love all this kind of stuff. And this weekend, actually Monday, the US, most of the US, I mean, a remarkable amount of states are going to be in the path of a total eclipse. And that is the coolest thing basically in the world, I think. So I live in Chicago and not that far south, I think maybe 4 or 5 hour drive, is going to be completely in the path of totality, which means the sun will disappear behind the moon for a couple of minutes next Monday.
That's so cool.
And I am geeking out about it. I really am. I just think it's like the world just goes dark and you go like, oh yeah, that's right. It's not just light during the day and dark at night. It's because the sun shines on us and sometimes the moon's in the way. And that just is like, it just kind of, I think, immediately zooms your perspective out from kind of surveys on Southeast Asia to like, oh yeah, you know, none of this stuff actually in
none
the long
of this
term. We're all just dust. So I'm excited about that. The International Intrigue newsletter today, this morning, we collated a couple of cool links, a beautiful essay about what it's like to be in an eclipse or in the path of totality, and also an excellent comic about why you have to actually be in a full total eclipse, because a partial solar, as someone who's seen a partial solar eclipse, it's not that cool. It's just like the clouds kind of went across the sun for a bit.
You either go full eclipse or nothing. Go full or go
exactly.
Home.
Yeah, exactly. Dimitri, you're trying to say something, but you are
I'm just outraged. You're telling people we're all just dust over canapes and I'm the buzzkill.
Yeah, you know what? But it's with a sense of wonder and joy in my heart, Dimitri. It's a good point. Helen, why don't you take us out with what you're going to be discussing in Sydney this weekend when you go and have a couple of beers down the pub?
Down the pub? You mean, going for my kayak and Point Piper.
Point
if you know, Piper. You know. look, I was going to talk about my stuff, which is quite grim, and it was about the Tomb Sweeping Festival and how that's gone virtual these days in China after COVID, and then talking about this latest Korean cult flick, which is about, you know, called Exuma, and it's about this this sort of, you know, Korean occult and other gravestone stuff. But that's, you know, not light enough. But I am actually going to be heading to Perth in a few hours, actually, so no sleep for me tonight. And I'll be taking quokka selfies. Now, for those who know quokkas, they are possibly Australia's cutest native animals, much cuter than, you know, your koalas and kangaroos.
And can't kill you, which is rare.
Which is very rare.
Well, I suppose
rare,
they
correct.
Could, but...
Yeah, and doesn't have chlamydia, so, you know, that helps. So I'll be patting some quokkas and taking selfies on this Rottnest Island location, which is where, you know, the Hemsworth brothers had famously made them famous back in, you know, the late 2010s. So, yeah, watch this space, Helen and Quokka.
So don't feed them and don't touch them, otherwise you go to jail, right?
For legal reasons, Helen is not actually going to pat them, which would be illegal.
Correct. I mean, yes, exactly. Yeah. Great. Thanks, guys.
Don't... But I'm jealous. Perth is, it's a long way from anywhere. I think it's literally the most isolated major city on the planet, but it is a really, really stunning part of the world. So enjoy that a lot. All right, folks, that does it again for us this week. I hope you enjoyed that conversation. I personally found that enlightening and interesting. So I thank you both, as always, for sharing your wisdom with me. Dimitri, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Helen, have a great weekend. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you, John.
And we will see you all next week. Thank you very much.
Dialogue editing, mixing, and mastering for this episode was done by Marissa Ewing of Hemlock Creek Productions.